Welcome to Tales from the Dance Floor, a podcast exploring the lives and times of people from all walks of life who follow their passions and made careers out of DJing, producing, parties, dance culture, and the music industry. I'm Phil Morse from Digital DJ Tips. Let's get started. So I'd like to welcome Rachel Lynch, otherwise DJ Rachel, to the podcast. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
So, Rachel, let me big you up before we get going. As far as I'm concerned, you are a unique person in this world in so many ways. You are one of the few people I would invite on this podcast who is not a full-time DJ. That's number one. We'll talk about that. You're a girl in what is predominantly a man's world. That is of interest for sure. You are an interesting kind of event DJ, and I think we want to dig into that, the kind of events that naturally attract you and you are attracted to. And you're also an absolute superstar, an internet superstar and a superstar on the ground in the United States. And I've got proof of that because when I came to the DJ Expo in the US last year, I was amazed at the number of people stopping me when I went to breakfast and when I was off to, you know, whatever. There was always someone, hey, Phil. And I was like, wow, you know, people actually follow the website and they know me. And the only person in that whole place, and let me paint the picture, it's in Atlantic City. It's got thousands and thousands of DJs from all over, certainly the East Coast, probably nationwide, US, attend this place. The only person I saw getting similar treatment was you. So, Rachel, you're quite a character. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. And I just want to start off by asking an obvious question. How the hell did you get into DJing?
Oh boy, it's quite an interesting story. So first, thank you so much for having me on here. I really appreciate the opportunity to just talk about the industry and the unique ups and downs and just, you know, to the community out there about what's going on and, you know, how things have been for me. So I've actually been doing this about 15 years now, but really seriously about 8 is when my company started to develop. So in terms of how I got started, it begins about 15 years ago where one morning we woke up to a loud crash in my house and we found my brother, who was also a DJ, on the floor unconscious. At the time, we had no idea what was going on. So obviously we called 911 for an ambulance. The ambulance came to my house. Now, mind you, I live in the middle of nowhere. So it was about a half an hour response time. So my family and I were freaking out, very upset. And I knew he had a wedding that day. We were talking about it over dinner the night before. And obviously he was packing the car and doing his pre-event check with his gear, making sure he had everything. I even remember helping him load some stuff in the car himself. So at this time, I wasn't a DJ. I just was baby sister, you know, kind of in tune with what he was doing and helped him out where I could. But I definitely was not a DJ and had no idea what I was doing. So after he got whisked off to the hospital, I realized that this couple now didn't have a DJ that day. So I figured I would be better than nothing. So I asked my father at the time to help me finish up loading up the car. Now, mind you, this is really before powered speakers. This was all a passive system, very heavy amps that were between 90 and 100 pounds. Again, I had no idea how to hook it up. So I said, Dad, I need your support, but, you know, let's show up to their house and, you know, let them know what happened. And when we arrived, I explained that my brother was in the ICU. We have no idea what's going on. So whatever information they could front load me within the next half an hour, things that I need to know in terms of how to pronounce names and who's in their wedding party and, you know, the critical moments. The bride was absolutely beside herself as well as the groom. They were very hard to calm down, actually, and understandably so. But I promised them, you know, I would do the best I could for their special day. And after probably the most stressful day of my entire life, other than maybe my driving test, I pulled it off. And then I said to myself, you know, if I could do this, I could do anything. And I realized I had a little bit more natural talent than I had thought because of my background and, you know, the instruments I had played and just being around music and my brother and stuff. So after that, my brother realized that I was capable of doing a little bit more assistant-like work. So he would, you know, pass me some events here and there, very low-key, very basic stuff, nothing too complicated. And then those clients ended up calling me back through word of mouth instead of him. And then here we are, 15 years later, I've grown my own personal business.
That's an incredible story. I mean, there's so much to talk about there, Rachel. Is your brother still DJing?
He is, but we have completely two different businesses.
Wow. So look, we're going to talk about that, obviously, but I want to just paint, you know, people will be listening to this thinking, well, this girl's clearly got some balls, if you don't mind me using that phrase. She's clearly got the ability to jump unflappably into situations, and these are good skills to have in any part, in any area of life, but clearly they've served you in your DJing. But I just want to paint the picture about how far you've gone with this, because you've opened for George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic. You've opened for Gloria Gaynor. You've done some pretty big gigs. You've, in that 15 years and in the 8 years you've been doing it seriously, you haven't just trod water or kind of stumbled through this. You've hit some pretty big highs, right?
Absolutely. The journey has been incredible, and it is nothing that I could have ever have dreamed of. I never grew up wanting to be a DJ. You know, people say, oh, I was born with turntables in my hand and it was always my dream. Like, I wanted to be a paramedic. I wanted to be a school teacher. I went to college full time. I've worked as a security officer my entire life. Like, nothing really revolved around music per se, just other than my own personal enjoyment. So if you would have asked me 15 years ago, if I would have, as you said, you know, opened for the, you know, the epic artists like Gloria Gaynor and George Clinton, I never would have dreamed it. But I think what really got me to where I was is once I got over being afraid. I was afraid to fail. I was afraid that I didn't know enough, that I didn't really have the foundation, so to speak, to do what I do. Once I stopped saying no, that's when life really took off for me. I just said, what have I got to lose? So these particular people don't like me, or I bomb at this gig. Like, how else are you going to learn? How else are you going to grow unless you get feedback, criticism, or you fail? So it's really just about dusting off the knees and trying again. But everyone's been really wonderful to me. Anyone who I've reached out in the community for support or advice or tips, you know, I've had a lot of great mentors. You know, I would not say that I took this journey alone, so to speak. But it's really just about saying yes and giving it a shot.
Well, there's a saying about success that is, you know, you don't need genius, you need seniors. And seniors mean a combination of the word seen and genius, right? So you tap into something, you tap into a scene, you tap into a community. And you, I think, are a great example of someone who's done that. And by the way, I'm not knocking any genius that you have got and are not admitting to here at all. But look, you have spent a lot of time reaching out to people, and I mean not customers, but other DJs and people in this industry, and getting your foot in their doors and getting to know them and helping them and, you know, supporting what they do. And then the support's come back your way. And I think from my point of view, that seems to be something that has been a key to your success. You're on YouTube a lot. You've done some YouTube stuff for digital DJ tips, but I hunted you down having already seen you getting involved with other people who are trying to help DJs along. And you were, as I said, very, very well known at the, you know, anywhere you go. And we've now bumped into each other in a couple of big public conferences in the States. And it's the same wherever you go. So was this deliberate? Did you deliberately think, right, this is how I'm going to do it. I'm going to get out there and meet everyone. And, or did it just kind of like happen that way?
So the motivation behind really hitting this career head on came from a lot of the hardships and the criticism and the rude comments that I got from people. You know, when you're putting stuff on social media, you know, for every 5 comments you get that are positive, you get one that, you know, really cuts deep. And if I showed you some of the things in my inbox, you would be beside yourself. I've absolutely thought about quitting a couple times. You know, why would I do this to myself? Why am I putting myself out there on this platform to get criticized and made fun of? Everything from, you know, people calling you chubby to do you even know how to mix, accusing you of being a quote Paris Hilton, playing pre-recorded sets, and just everything that's come through my way. And rather than getting mad, I decided to get motivated. So that's really where my YouTube channel came from. I figured if people don't want to believe what I can do, well, I'm going to show them what I could do. So they have no choice but to see who I am, how I do it, pull back the curtains, be very vulnerable, very transparent. It was kind of a risky move, but I figured it was what I needed to do to get over those hurdles that where people were just undermining me and being really cruel and trying to take away my sparkle. So,
well, it's funny you should say that, because I think sparkle is something that you've got in spades, and it comes through in the kind of gigs you play. Now, I've been following you quite closely, watching your style and watching the kind of things that you're into. And, you know, most DJs in the event mobile space, weddings is what they go for. Weddings is where the money is. Weddings, you know, you attach the word wedding to it, the price doubles or trebles instantly. And that seems to be pretty much the norm. The really successful DJs are the ones who've cracked weddings, right? And that's kind of the norm out there. But that's not you, is it? You've got your own little niche. And you've already said that what you do differs from your brother. I'm going to wildly guess, not knowing anything about your brother's business, that he chases weddings. But you don't, do you, Rachel? You've got a completely, well, you know, I don't want to big you up too much, but it is an original take on it. What you go for, it's kind of, well, explain to people the kind of the thing that attracts you and that you seem to attract.
Well, from what I hear a lot out in the community is this delineation between club DJ and wedding DJ. And that's really like the DJ universe. They just kind of split it into these two categories. And then people talk about, you know, the undercutters, and they're losing work to the bottom feeder DJs. And it kind of makes my head want to explode, because there is so much opportunity to work and find clients and different creative avenues. There are so many types of events that need music. So just to give you an example, my entire business plan is probably only 30% actual weddings. Everything else is whatever else I can pick up and kind of who I'm seeking out, who I'm marketing to, and again, just saying yes. So a couple of the unique events. So again, being a concert opener, like the ones you pointed out, I actually just did a town fireworks show last weekend. So literally they had about 18,000 people come out to this fireworks display.
Wow.
I was the DJ during the actual fireworks display. They also had a band, so I was playing in between acts. A couple years ago, I was the DJ for an FHL hockey team. So over here in the States, you know, there's like the NHL and there's different levels. So this is a step above college. So it's the first tier of, quote, professional hockey. So I was a team's hockey DJ. I do gyms, which has been an awesome, awesome platform for me, because who's at this gym? You know, 25 to 45 year olds, typically females. So people are getting married. They know their girlfriend needs a DJ, you know, bachelorette parties. So I can't tell you how much work I've gotten just from that particular business. Plus, they're a really great staple in the community. They're very well-known, reputable business. So their brand helps my brand, and my brand helps their brand. And it's been a wonderful relationship. Obviously, I do clubs and bars. Obviously, I do some weddings. I also do so there's this local company that runs these professional dance sessions, and they do I guess they do ticketed performances for local people. I don't want to call it a talent show, but it's a local dance group, and they need a DJ to play the tracks, you know, for all their performers. So I do that for them. A ton of community events. There's something in the States called National Night Out, where everybody in the United States on Tuesday in August has a community-based event to kind of strengthen the partnership between police and the community. So I'm in the community. You got to reach out. You got to get creative. But weddings is really only about 30% of what I do.
you're almost, and I know you'll take this the right way, but you're almost a novelty DJ. You seek novelty. You seek places where no DJ has gone before and see if it's possible. Is this kind of like in your psyche? Is this just what you love?
Well, it's what keeps it exciting for me. It keeps me fresh. It keeps me on my toes, you know, having to do, for example, the George Clinton event. You know, I did probably 2 months of research before that event because I was booked several months in advance. So I was watching documentaries on the culture, you know, where the music came from, the inspiration of these artists, you know, political stuff that was going on at the time, because I knew that there were going to be hardcore funk fans there, and I needed to deliver and execute an exquisite set, and I couldn't be predictable or just something that you could pop on Pandora or something like that. Like, I really wanted to deliver. So I enjoy the work that goes into being challenged. Even with the fireworks display, you know, you have 18,000 different tastes, different backgrounds, different ages. You have veterans there. You know, so a way to deliver a set tastefully and not offend anybody, and making sure you're hitting, you know, what's important and emotional to them. So I really like the work behind it.
Mm. So tell us about the George Clinton gig. Tell us a bit more about what it involved, what it was like.
So I was petrified. I was so taken back that I was asked to do it in the first place. And I'm like, oh my God, like, how on earth am I ever going to come up with an opening set? So it started with going on YouTube, and I just started watching a ton of documentaries, specifically on George Clinton. There's a ton of great content about, again, their origins, where they came from, how they got together, their trials, their tribulations, about the political scene back in that day. And from there, I was also kind of listening to the music that they had playing in the background. And then I went to the internet and I did research, and I listened to those artists and then researched them. So I was taking pretty much like college school notes on these bands and where they came from. And then from there, I had to trim the fat because I only had a 45-minute set, and I knew that I had to take them on a complete journey of what was really important, without being predictable. You know, you could just go on, you know, top 100 from this decade, but I didn't want to play all bangers. I wanted to find the little nuggets that people wouldn't have thought to have played, and really pay tribute to that culture and experience. So it started with a ton of research. I definitely did have the set pre-planned. Like, I knew what I was going to play because I had to have it, you know, fit within a 40-minute set. And I practice probably 4 hours a day just to make sure that I got it right. And obviously setting the cue points and, you know, labeling where the hot loops needed to go. It was probably one of the most orchestrated things that I've planned out. But I felt that night there was no margin of error, because again, it was like in front of an audience of about 20,000 people. So it was incredible. I had butterflies in my stomach. I was sweating. And what I was also nervous about, and I'm trying to put this, you know, as lightly as possible, but being a female and a Caucasian female opening up for one of the funk legends, I can tell you that there was a lot of people in that audience when they saw me front and center stage, kind of like, who is this? Like, almost kind of like, who does she think she is coming here thinking she's going to rock this audience before this legendary, you know, funk group? And I had a lot of pressure, and there was a lot of expectation put on me. And then after the show, to this day, one of my proudest moments was the, I don't know, 10 or 12 people, you know, while I was cleaning up my gear, and said, you know, I don't know how you know what you know, meaning for my age and obviously, you know, race and all that, but they go, thank you for paying homage and giving us the time of our life tonight. And I can't explain that feeling. So that was kind of scary for me because I didn't fit the profile of what they thought should have been the opening act for George Clinton.
So that's an incredible story. I've got kind of my hairs are standing on end just thinking about it. You tell it very well. How did you get the gig? How did that even happen?
So I have a very great partnership with a local town in Connecticut, and they have a fabulous community, and it's Hamden, Connecticut, and they throw a free summer concert series every year with an incredible acts, and it doesn't cost the town anything because it's kind of built into their budget for the year. And one of the ladies who works for the town happens to be a member at that gym that I was telling you. So again, it's all about the connections.
Mm. That's right. It's great. And it sounds absolutely fantastic. So what do you do week in, week out, month in, month out to kind of expand your musical horizons, to keep you at the cutting edge, to get you ready for all the kinds of things that might be thrown your way? I mean, you've been doing this for nearly a decade now, really seriously. So presumably, if another gig like that came your way, you'd be a lot more in your stride, right? You're learning very quickly how to deal with the unusual, I guess. What do you do? Are you a member of record pools? Do you just, you love music documentaries and you're always trying to push yourself that way? Do you go out a lot and hear music that you wouldn't normally hear? What's your kind of way of keeping up front and fresh and interested in different types of music?
So first I'd say it starts with knowing that these gigs don't happen by accident. If you think you're just going to show up with a laptop with a bunch of music, it doesn't work like that. Again, it's about the research. It's about really being in tune in terms of what the client is asking you. And I now know the time and dedication it takes to deliver something like that. In terms of how to stay fresh and on top of what needs to be played when. So first, back to my roots. My parents have an extensive vinyl collection. I grew up playing with it. I was yelled at a couple times for touching it. But I have to thank, you know, my mom and dad for having music on 24/7 and always having the radio on. And it's really how we bonded as a family. So I got a lot of my grassroots training, so to speak, really early on as a child. I also was in a lot of talent shows. I was in band. I play the piano. So obviously I've had that whole exposure to different types of, you know, classical pieces, jazz pieces. So that's helped me tremendously. Then in terms of, you know, staying current, I subscribe to a ton of record pools, constantly filtering through the music on there, XM radio, Spotify, Google Play. I have music on 24/7. And ironically, I don't really listen to music for me anymore. Any downtime that I have, it's me doing music discovery. Very seldomly, maybe only when I'm laying in bed at night trying to go to sleep, will I be able to put on, you know, some music that I truly enjoy. But if I have an hour long commute to work, so there and back, you know, music discovery. I also go online a lot, forums, Facebook chat groups. I'm constantly Shazamming. Just, it's a 24/7 process. My brain literally never turns off when it comes to acquiring music, what might work, what to play. And another thing that I like to talk about, and you know, I apologize if I'm derailing this conversation, but is requests. I hear this debate all the time with DJs that despise requests and people throwing off their set and the vibe with, you know, their off-kilter desires of what they want to hear. No matter how bizarre the request, and even if I don't know what it is or if I don't have it, I will either write it down or take a screenshot of it with my phone, because when I have a moment to myself, I will listen to every single request that anyone has ever asked me for, because I don't know if it's something that could be amazing at a different event, just maybe not for this one, but I use it as an opportunity to learn about what people want out there. And maybe it's something that I've never heard of. There's no way a DJ could ever be aware of any and all music out there. So why would you shun away an opportunity to be more in tune with, you know, what people are actually listening to out in the world? So that's another big thing for me, is requests I take very seriously, even if I don't play it.
Well, I mean, we're getting into the technical side of how to do this game now. And it's something that seeing we're suddenly talking about requests, let's talk about it for a minute. As someone who's DJed most of my life too, I'm kind of with you on that. And I love the fact that you don't feel the need to play everything the second you're asked for it, because guess what? They're requests, right? It's in the word. It's a request. But I've always personally had this kind of hierarchy where you've got the girls who are dancing on the dance floor, that their requests get, if I'm marking them personally, their requests get lots of marks. And then you have the guy in the t-shirt from a band that you've never heard of before who kind of shuffles over and asks for something. And you kind of know his mates have said, go and ask for an album track off the obscure band that no one knows. And I guess you have to have this filter, don't you, that says, you know, some requests are more equal than others. While at the same time, as you say, there's nothing wrong with going away and listening to them, right?
Right. So I will always listen to them later on, might not play at that gig, but I just see it as an opportunity to see, you know, what do people care about out there? And I've actually come across some really good tracks that way.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, listen, let's go back to your kind of upbringing. So it's kind of becoming clear that this very gregarious, outgoing personality, this girl who's happy to jump up on stage, and thankfully you've carried it through to adult life and dealt with the inevitable and sad backlash that comes from that. You know, this comes from your childhood. Was there a kind of community involvement element in your childhood as well? Because that seems to be very important in the way that you conduct your life and therefore get your gigs. This being involved in the community and the people around you, is that something you learned from an early age?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am from a very, very small town in Connecticut, Sherman, Connecticut, where we have no high school, no police station, no hospital, one volunteer ambulance. There's nothing here. So all you have is the community. We're a lake-based community, so there's a lot of boating and beaching and just really kind neighbors, and everybody knows everybody just because it's such a small space. So I've always really been a very community-based individual. It's just, it's how I grew up.
And so does that not come with its own difficulties? Because, of course, if you're in a small place, surely the amount of work that's surrounding you isn't massive. So do you have to go a long way to play your gigs? Do you have to go a long way to even meet people who can get you gigs? How does that kind of work when you're living in such a small place? Are you still there, I guess? Is if not, then that's understand. No, then you're answering my question. But are you still there?
Yes, I am. So my father passed away a couple years ago, and I kind of had to move back with my mom just to kind of help her take care of some things, you know, around the house and just support her. So really, any event that I have is at least a 40-minute drive. Any of my bar and club gigs, they're up near Hartford, Connecticut, which is predominantly one of the main cities out here. So it is a long haul for me to get to events.
So, but presumably you were a bit more in the city, a bit more when you built your business up, right? So that's kind of like, that answers my question, that you were a bit more in the middle of things over the last few years until recently.
Not really. It's just been word of mouth and social media. And I just kind of drive to where I need to be. If someone says, hey, we need a DJ, I don't complain. I just show up and do the work. But the willingness to travel has absolutely been a huge component to my business. Otherwise, I wouldn't have survived.
Yeah, it sounds like a car is definitely essential where you live.
I actually own 5 cars.
Unbelievable scenes. I've never met anyone who owns 5 cars before.
Yes, I have a truck that hauls the DJ gear. I have a daily driver, which is my commuter car to and from work. I have an SUV that I use for my smaller gigs where I don't need a huge, large pickup, but I have to be able to fit, you know, couple tops and stands and things like that. Then I'm also a car enthusiast, and I have a show car that I take on my downtime. Oh, and that's another thing I wanted to bring up. Car shows. I do a ton of them around the state. And because I have a show car, I'm kind of well known for that. So that's also how I got these events. So again, when we're going back to, you know, thinking outside the box, and you know, there's so many places and businesses and events that need music that you don't just have to be a wedding DJ or a club DJ. That's another thing that I do, is a lot of car show events. So
have you ever thought about rigging out a vehicle with a huge sound system in it, like the ones that you can see at festivals and stuff, that are just pimped up to the max with subwoofers and lights and all that?
Absolutely. So mine is kind of like that. I just don't have the ability at this point in time to connect a DJ controller to it. But in terms of sound, bass, and lights, I'll have to show it to you sometime. It's pretty remarkable.
It does sound that way. So talking of Pretty Remarkable, you have a, well, to start with, for someone who is clearly very successful, very driven and very dedicated to the world of DJing, to most people that would sound like a full-time job. But guess what? You've also got a full-time job. And it's not your run-of-the-mill full-time job. What exactly is it that you do 9 to 5?
So I work for a corporate security company as a trainer. We have uniformed security personnel that provide security services to anything from hotels to schools to manufacturing plants, you name it, we provide security personnel. And in the state of Connecticut, we have to have a license to do security. So just how you would need a driver's license, you also need a license to be a security officer, just to make sure that your background's screened and you're trained. And in essence, you know what you're doing because you're working in a public safety position. So it's my job to make sure that these officers are trained and in compliance with not only state requirements, but also what the client needs them to be proficient at. So on a typical 9 to 5, I teach anything from first aid and CPR all the way to active shooter training.
Active shooter training. So what does that involve?
So it's pretty intense. We provide it both to our guards, and also businesses can hire us to come in and do a risk assessment, kind of look for vulnerabilities at the property. You know, how would a quote bad guy get in? How can they fortify their establishment? We do a 90-minute actual course on how to run, how to hide, how to fight, warning signs, what to do when you hear certain noises, just to give them a sense of awareness that, you know, this can happen here. I live in Connecticut. We have, you know, the worst school shooting in the history of the world. I live about 15 minutes from Newtown, Connecticut. So the reality is very real here in our state. And then we actually do a simulation where we come in with air-powered simulated guns, and we run a 8-minute exercise pretending to shoot within the facility, and we allow the people to respond accordingly based on what they hear and what they see to see if they could get to safety and how they would protect themselves if an incident were to occur in their business.
So you basically set up simulated attacks on businesses. Are you one of the people who actually jumps in with these pretend guns and pretends to be one of the bad guys?
Yes, absolutely. I strap a GoPro to myself and we record the whole entire incident. So the business itself can learn where are points in the building that people got caught because the hallway narrows, or there was only one egress in a room, or the people panicked and froze and didn't move. It's all captured on camera as part of the learning experience. So yes, it's myself and one other employee that go in and run these drills. It's really surreal. It's almost even hard to explain, to be honest with you. And I still to this day can't believe that that's like an expectation of my job, which is why DJing is like an escape for me. You know, I'm surrounded by tragedy and horrible statistics and fear, you know, all day. Like, security is a very serious position. So I get to see the worst in people and the best in people.
It does sound like you've got this kind of yin and yang going on, but it's, you know, a lot of people will think that sounds like quite an exciting job, you know, running around tooled up, pretending to be a bad guy. I mean, do people sometimes mistake it for a real event, a real incident? And does it ever got out of hand, or is it too controlled for that?
No. So these drills take months of planning. We coordinate with the local police department and EMS. The day of the drill, we will call the police department saying, you know, in about 5 minutes, we're going to begin the simulation. So if you get any 911 calls on accident, you know, it's just a drill. We usually have a police officer on property, you know, just to make sure things kind of stay on the up and up. And everybody's given advance notice because you can never run a surprise active shooter drill because, you know, if someone has a concealed carry and isn't aware what's going on, if they think it's a real incident, it's not really going to end well for everybody. Mm. So there's a ton of planning and communication that goes on beforehand.
Well, that's incredible. I can't imagine. I honestly can't imagine. And like you say, it does seem to me like DJing is a bit of an escape from that. And I guess also DJing can't really throw anything at you that you haven't experienced something a little bit more intense elsewhere in your life, right? So it's kind of arming you, if you don't mind me using the word, for anything that could happen at nighttime.
Right. Absolutely. It's definitely changed the way I DJ and my awareness. When I'm in the nightclub, I definitely position my table a certain way. I make sure that I have access to get out of places. I constantly am watching who's coming in and out the door, people's body language. I operate much differently than probably most DJs.
And actually, funnily enough, that might feed into reading crowds and just understanding the vibe of a room. It might be something very positive from that hyper alert nature as to who's in and what mood they're in and so on. There's probably a bit of an overlap there, right?
Absolutely. I'm very sensitive to body language and eye contact and nonverbal cues. And it's definitely a positive, but also I don't want to use the word stressful, but when I'm in a nightclub environment, I'm definitely in a different mindset than if I were at a private birthday party or something like that. But it has made me a much better crowd reader.
So you've got a full on life. It's pretty intense in all areas. I think it's probably fair to say. What do you do away from both the DJing and the work if you find any time? What's your downtime look like?
So I have a couple of I'm a busybody, so I don't really have downtime per se, but I just partake in activities that relax me. So I love painting. I'm a big painter. I love playing the piano. I wish I had more time to do so, but that's also very relaxing to me. And really the car show scene, I really enjoy just getting in my car and going for a cruise with the music blasting and enjoying the fresh air.
So what about making music? You're a piano player, you're a musician. Any thoughts of making music, producing music? Do you do that? Do you make your own kind of re-edits and stuff for your shows? You got anything in that direction?
Nothing really contemporary or really DJ related. It's more just actual music, piano ballads, just kind of, just playing stuff that comes to my mind and creating that way, but nothing that would really translate into actual DJing or making, sound packs or beats or things like that.
Have you got any desire to do that at some point in the future? Is it something that interests you?
Not really. And honestly, I don't think I would have the time to dedicate to it. I kind of enjoy being hyper mobile, getting plopped into these unique DJ events and doing the research and actually playing the gigs. I'm not really a behind the desk kind of girl. Mm.
You like the immediacy of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to talk to you about social media, because social media is something that I think you've used positively and definitely to your advantage. Do you have any kind of underlying philosophy about how you use social media and YouTube and Instagram and Facebook and so on? Or did you just kind of like feel your way along when you started your business and get into these platforms as they grew? What was or is your approach to it all?
So back in the day when Facebook kind of was first a thing, I had two profiles. I had a personal profile and a business profile, a DJ Rachel profile. And I made one all about DJing and what I was doing and the club flyers and, all the propaganda that pretty much all friends and family hate. And I had my personal profile with, pictures of the dog and vacations and my love of Spider-Man and pizza and, just all things truly me. And I thought that I had to have that delineation. And when I got tired of switching back and forth between these two accounts, and I was starting to post on DJ forums with my personal account, and people kind of saw a little bit more of the actual me interjected, not this, billboard that I painted on my other business page. I noticed that I was getting a lot more engagement. A lot more people wanted to know who I was, and they would just message me or tag me in things. And then it kind of like a light bulb went off, and I said, why the hell am I trying to be somebody I'm not? Like, why am I drawing this delineation between two universes of, you know, Rachel, of what I think people want me to be and who I actually am? So I started on my DJ page to breathe more of the real me in there. And from there, things really, really took off. So my first tip, I guess, is just to be authentic and really just be you. Now, I will tell you, though, there is a line. You know, there's things that I'd like to say that I don't, or post that I don't, because I realize it's a public platform and you are absolutely being judged for how you conduct yourself, what you say, you know, the pages you follow, the comments you're making, the language that you're using. So you have to be mindful of that to a certain extent, but definitely just be you.
So a big part of how you do that is training, being very, very generous with your knowledge. As I said a little bit earlier on in our conversation, you've shared knowledge on our channels, which has gone down extremely well with our audience. But I know you've done some stuff for lots of other people as well. I was looking at some of the stuff you've done for IDJ Now. Seems to be a big part of how you like to share is to share knowledge. Is that something that, again, is you've drifted into, or was it part of some kind of plan?
Well, it was part of that mission to show people that, you know, I'm capable, I'm professional, I'm detail-oriented, and I really take what I do seriously, that I'm not just, you know, a cute face with some turntables playing house music, fist pumping. You know, like, there's actually substance behind what I do, which is why I kind of took the educational route. And a lot of my successes come from, you know, I give a lot more than I take. And because I'm willing to give and help out, I have people messaging me at 3 o'clock in the morning about troubleshooting with virtual DJ or their Denon controller, because I'm a big Denon DJ fan, you know, or my gear review videos that I do for IDJ Now, if they're having, you know, a little difficulty with getting something situated, you know, I'm there, I'm accessible, I care. And I feel that because the community sees that I'm so willing to help out, because I feel, you know, if the individual wants to succeed, we all have to succeed as a community. We all win when we all are acting professionally, know what we're doing, have great customer service, are using professional gear, know how to use it. You know, we elevate the industry that way. And that's kind of my mission, to just be a breath of fresh air, breathe kindness into the industry. I don't judge people, whether you're just beginning or you've been doing this 35 years and you're not really familiar with something. Like, I'm here for you. And I think that's really a big part of my brand. And that's helped, you know, people, or foster relationships and really help me connect with people.
Well, it's definitely working, Rachel. And so I guess the logical conclusion would be going full time. Is that something that's ever occurred to you? Is it something that you'd want to do? Or do you like the balance that you've got now?
I enjoy the balance. I don't think I would ever go full time. Having this yin and yang, as you say, it allows me to truly find clients that I know we have amazing chemistry. I don't have to take on nightmare clients or difficult clients for the sake of putting food on the table. So every event I do, when everyone's like, Rach, you're so happy, you're so positive, I love your energy, like, you know, they look at the gig logs, and it's because every client is because I wanted to be there. There's nothing forced. There's nothing. It's very organic. And I love having that flexibility and control over what I do and who I do it for.
And does it have a shelf life? Is it possible that at some point in the future you are not going to want to do this anymore? Do you see it as something with a limited time span in your life? Or again, is it something that you just can't imagine not having as part of what you do?
Well, personally, I feel like I'm just getting started. Like, the world is just starting to open for me. So in terms of my shelf life, I got at least another 50 years in me. I don't see myself not having some component of entertaining or DJing in my life. And like I said, the past 2-3 years have been the biggest for me. Like, I'm just starting to really find my niche and loving what I do. So no time soon.
Well, so where do you see it going? If you close your eyes and think 10 years ahead, you know, what in your wildest dream, where are you DJing? Who for? What's it look like?
So I would love to be a brand ambassador for someone, whether it's Denon, Pioneer. I would love to go and do trade shows and trainings and kind of travel the country and connect with DJs and teach and do seminars. And I love that whole sector that I never even dreamed of again 15 years ago as a DJ, you know, being that kind of member in the community. I would love to kind of take that on next.
I think that's something that you could do a lot sooner than a decade away, Rachel. You could probably get started next summer, frankly, with that kind of thing. And believe me, there are people who listen to this podcast who can help you with that kind of thing. And I've even interviewed some of them. So I predict boldly that that's something that you're going to find yourself doing sooner rather than later. Rachel, you've been a fantastic guest. It's been wonderful catching up with you. And as I always say, you know, these are often the times I get to talk more to my friends than at any other point. So I've learned things about you today that I didn't know. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and do this.
And I hope we actually get a chance to meet again in person soon. I'm sure we will. Rachel, you have a great day. And thanks for coming on Tales from the Dance Floor.
Cheers.